वक्रतुंड महाकाय सूर्यकोटिसमप्रभा निर्विघ्नं कुरु मे देव सर्वकार्येषु सर्वदा शिवशक्त्या युक्तो यदि भवति शक्तः प्रभवितुम् न चेदेवं देवो न खलु कुशलः स्पन्दितुमपि अथ स्त्वामाराध्या हरिहर विरिञ्चाधिभिरपि प्रणन्तुं स्तोतुं वा कथमकृतपुण्यः प्रभवति
Om Shri Sai Ram. At the outset, my most loving and prayerful salutations at the divine lotus feet of our most beloved Bhagwan, Shri Satya Sai Baba. Dear listener, you are tuned to Radio Sai Global Harmony on Asia Stream, bringing you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the love and the message of Bhagwan Shri Satya Sai Baba. Good morning, greetings and loving Sai Ram on this Thursday, on the 24th of September 2020, and you're with me, Team Radio Sai's Sunil, welcoming you once again to this morning's segment, Divine Glory, on Thursday live from the studios of the Sri Satya Sai Media Center here at Prashanthi Nilayam. For the last few weeks, we had made a pause in our offerings of this segment, Divine Glory, that was due to the COVID-19 restrictions and regulations. And now, by Swami's grace, we are back on track. At the outset, let me read out to you today's Sai Inspires message. What is the primary quality we should strive to develop? Bhagwan explains, drawing examples from the life of Lord Shri Krishna, and I quote, "The cow transforms grass and gruel into sweet, strength-giving milk and gives it away in plenty to its master. Develop that quality, that power to transform the food you consume into sweet thoughts, words and deeds of sympathy for all. The child Krishna wept for permission to go along with the cows to the fields of pasture. Yashoda said, 'Dear child, your tiny silken soles cannot walk along those thorny pebble-filled tracks. I shall get nice little sandals for you. You can go after the sandals are ready.' But Krishna sweetly replied, 'Mother, the cows whom we serve are not shod. Why should we, who are their servants, avoid the thorns and stones which they cannot avoid? No wonder the cows and calves of Gokul were immobilized and wept when Krishna left for Mathura. When you have filled your heart with sympathy for the distressed, the Lord will shower His grace.'" Unquote. This was taken from a divine discourse delivered by Bhagwan on January 11, 1968. Dear listener, today in Divine Glory, I have lined up for you readings from the English version of the holy book, Sri Sai Satcharitra, written by Sri Hemant Pant, followed by the second part of a conversation with Dr. Ramanathan Iyer about Ayurveda. In conversation with him is Professor G. Venkatraman, the former Vice Chancellor of the Sri Satya Sai Institute of Higher Learning and also the former director of Radio Sai, and this was recorded in the year 2007. But first, readings from Sri Sai Satcharitra. Sri Sai Satcharitra is an account on the life and teachings of Sai Baba of Shirdi, written by Sri Hemant Pant. We are thankful to Vasanthi Sundaram for reading out the contents from this holy book and to Veeramani Kannan for the melodious musical support. Wishing you all a happy, holy and a blessed Thursday and a wonderful day ahead. Samasta Lokaha Sukhino Bhavantu.
Chapter 11. Sai Asagun Brahma. Dr. Pandit's Worship. Haji Siddiq Phalke. Control over the elements. Let us now in this chapter describe the manifested Brahma Sai as to how he was worshipped and how he controlled the elements. Sai Asagun Brahma. There are two aspects of God or Brahma, the unmanifested Nirgun and the manifested Sagun. The Nirgun is formless while the Sagun is with form, though both denote the same Brahma. Some prefer to worship the former and some the latter. As stated in the Gita, the worship of the latter is easy and preferable. As man has got a form, body and senses, it is natural and easy for him to worship the God with form. Our love and devotion do not develop unless we worship Sagun Brahma for a certain period of time. And as we advance, it leads us to the worship of Nirgun Brahma. So, let us start with Sagun worship. Image, altar, fire, light, sun, water. Brahma are the seven objects of worship. But Sadguru is better than all of these. Let us on this occasion bring to our mind the form of Sai, who was non-attachment incarnate and who was a resting place for his devotees. Our faith in his words is the asan, and our sankalp is the abandonment of all our desires. Some say Sai was a Bhagavad Bhakt, devotee of the Lord. Others say he was a Mahabhagavat, a great devotee. But to us, he is God incarnate. He was ever forgiving, never irritable, straight, soft, tolerant and content beyond comparison. Though he looked unembodied, he was really disembodied, emotionless, unattached and internally free. The Ganges on its way to the sea cools and refreshes the creatures affected with heat, gives life to the crops and trees and quenches the thirst of many. Similarly, saints like Sai, while they live their own life, give solace and comfort to all. Lord Krishna has said, "The saint is my soul, my living image. I am he, or he is my pure form." This indescribable Shakti or power of God, known as pure existence, knowledge and bliss incarnated in the form of Sai in Shirdi. The Shruti, Taittiriya Upanishad, describes Brahma as pure bliss. This we read or hear daily in the books, but the devout people experiences Brahma or bliss in Shirdi. Baba, the support of all, required no prompt or asan from anybody. He always used a piece of sackcloth for a seat, which was covered with a small mattress by his bhaktas and had a bolster placed by them for resting his back. Baba respected the feelings of his devotees and allowed them to worship him as they liked. Some waved chamar or fans before him, some played on musical instruments, some washed his hands and feet, while the others applied scent and chandan. Some even gave him betel nut with leaves, and the others offered naivedya. Though he looked like living in Shirdi, he was present everywhere. This all-pervasiveness of his was daily experienced by his devotees. A humble prostration to this all-pervasive Sadguru. Dr. Pandit's worship. One Dr. Pandit, a friend of Tatya Sahib Nulkar, once came to Shirdi for Sai Baba's darshan. After saluting Baba, he sat in the masjid for some time. Baba asked him to go to Dada Bhai Khelkar. He went to Dada Bhai, by whom he was well received. Then, Dada Bhai left his house for puja and Dr. Pandit accompanied him. Dada Bhai worshipped Baba. Nobody until then dared to apply sandal paste to Baba's forehead. Only Mahasapati used to apply it to his throat. But this simple-hearted Dr. Pandit took Dada Bhai's dish containing puja materials and taking chandan out of it, drew a tripund, three horizontal lines on Baba's forehead. To the surprise of all, Baba kept silent without uttering a single word. Then Dada Bhai that evening asked Baba, "How is it that though you object to the sandal paste being applied by others to your forehead, you allow Dr. Pandit to do so?" Baba replied, "Dr. Pandit believed him to be the same as his guru, Raghunath Maharaj of Dhopeshwar, known as Kaka Puranik, and he applied the paste to his forehead as he was doing to his guru. Hence, he could not object." On inquiry, Dr. Pandit told Dada Bhai that he took Baba as his guru Kaka Puranik and realized him as the same. Hence, he marked the tripund on Baba's forehead as he did on his guru's. Though Baba allowed the devotees to worship him as they pleased, still sometimes he acted in a strange way. Sometimes he threw away the puja dish and was wrath incarnate. Then who could approach him? Sometimes he scolded the devotees. At times he looked softer than wax, a statue of peace and forgiveness. Though he seemed to shake with anger and his red eyes rolled round, still he was internally an ocean of affection and motherly love. He would call out his devotees and say that he never knew when he was ever angry with them. If it was possible that mothers could kick their children and the sea turn back the river, he too could neglect the devotees' welfare, that he, the slave of his devotees, always stood by them and responded to them whenever they called upon him, and that he always longed for their love. Haji Siddiq Phalke. There was no knowing as to when Baba would accept a devotee. That depended on his will. Siddiq Phalke's story is to the point. One Muslim gentleman by name Siddiq Phalke of Kalyan, after making pilgrimage to Mecca and Medina, came to Shirdi. He lived in the Chavadi facing north and sat in the open courtyard of the masjid. For 9 months Baba ignored him and did not allow him to step into the masjid. Phalke felt very sad and did not know what to do. Somebody advised him not to be disappointed, but to try to approach Baba through Shama, a close and intimate devotee of Baba. He told him that as they approached the Lord Shiva through the servant and devotee Nandi, so should Baba be approached through Shama. Phalke liked the idea and implored Shama to intercede for him. Shama agreed and on an convenient occasion spoke to Baba about him thus, "Baba, why don't you allow the old Haji to step into your masjid while so many persons freely come and go after taking your darshan? Why not bless him once?" Baba replied, "Shama, you are immature to understand these things. If the Allah does not allow, what can I do? Without his grace, who will climb into the masjid? Well, go to him and ask him whether he will come to the narrow footpath near the Barwi well." Shama went and returned with an affirmative answer. Again Baba said to Shama, "Ask him whether he is willing to pay me the sum of 40,000 rupees in 4 installments. Shama went and returned with the answer that he was willing to pay even 40 lakhs. Again Baba said to Shama, "We are going to cut a goat in the masjid, so ask him whether he would like to have its meat haunch or testicles of the goat." Shama returned with the answer that the Haji would be happy to receive a small crumb from Baba's mud pot. Hearing this, Baba got excited and with his hands threw away the earthen jars and the mud pot and straightaway advanced to the Haji and lifted his kafni up in the arms and said, "Why do you brag and pose yourself as an old Haji? Do you read Quran like this? You are proud of your pilgrimage to Mecca, but you do not know me." Being thus scolded, the Haji was confounded. Baba then went back to the masjid, purchased a basket of mangoes and sent them to the Haji. Then again Baba went to the Haji and taking out 55 rupees from his pocket, gave them in the Haji's hand. From then Baba loved the Haji, invited him for meals and the Haji thereafter came into the masjid whenever he liked. Baba gave him at times some rupees and thus Haji was enrolled into Baba's darbar. Baba's control over the elements. We shall close this chapter after describing 2 incidents showing Baba's control over the elements. Once at evening time, there was a terrible storm at Shirdi. The sky was overcast with thick black clouds. The winds began to blow with great force, the clouds roared and the lightning began to flash and the rain started pouring in torrents. In a short time, the whole place was flooded with water. All the creatures, birds, beasts and men got terribly frightened and they all flocked to the masjid for shelter. There are many local deities in Shirdi, but none of them came to the rescue. So they all prayed to Baba, their god, who was fond of their devotion, to intercede and quell the storm. Baba was much moved. He came out and, standing at the edge of the masjid, addressed the storm in a loud and thunderous voice, "Stop! Stop your fury and be calm!" In a few minutes, the rains subsided. The winds ceased to blow and the storm came to a stop. The moon rose in the sky and the people went back home well pleased. On another occasion at noon, the fire in the dhuni began to burn brightly. Its flames were reaching the rafters above. The people who were sitting in the masjid did not know what to do. They dared not ask Baba to pour water or do anything to quench the flames. But Baba soon came to realize what was happening. He took up his satka and dashed it against a pillar in front, saying, "Get down and be calm." At each stroke of the satka, the flames began to slow down, and in a few minutes, the dhuni became calm and normal. This is Asai, an incarnation of God. He will bless any man who will prostrate and surrender himself to him. He who will read the stories of this chapter daily with faith and devotion will soon be free from all calamities, and they'll be always attached and devoted to Sai. He will get very soon God vision. All his desires will be fulfilled and he will be ultimately desireless and attain the Supreme. Amen. Bow to Sri Sai. Peace be to all.
Chapter 12. Sai Leelas. Experiences of Kaka Mahajani. Dhumal Pleader. Mrs. Nimonkar, Mule Shastri, a doctor. Now let us see in this chapter how devotees were received and treated by Baba. Saint's Mission. We have seen before that the purpose or object of divine incarnation is to protect the good and destroy the wicked. But the mission of the saints is quite different. To them, the good and the wicked are the same. First, they draw the evildoers and set them on the right path. They are the Agasthi to destroy the Bhavasagar, or the sun to destroy the darkness of ignorance. The God dwells in the saints. In fact, they are not different from him. Asai is one of these, who incarnated for the welfare of the devotees, supreme in knowledge and surrounded by divine aura. He loved all beings equally. He was unattached. Foes and friends, kings and paupers, all were the same to him. For the sake of devotees, he gave a stock of merits and was ever alert to help them. But the devotees could never approach him unless he meant to receive them. If their appointed time did not come, they did not remember Baba, and his leelas could not reach their ears. Then how could they even think of him? Some men desired to see Sai Baba, but they did not get any opportunity of taking his darshan till his Mahasamadhi. There are many such persons whose desire for Baba's darshan was not satisfied. If these persons, believing in him, listen to his leelas, their quest for darshan will be to a great extent satisfied by those leelas. Even if some persons went there by sheer luck and took Baba's darshan, were they able to stay there longer? No, nobody could go there of his own accord, and no one could stay there longer if he did not wish so. They could stay there so long as Baba permitted them to stay, and had to leave the place when asked to do so by him. So everything depended on Baba's divine will. Kaka Mahajani. Once Kaka Mahajani went to Shirdi from Mumbai. He wanted to stay there for 1 week and enjoy the Gokulashtami festival. As soon as he took Baba's darshan, Baba asked him, "So, when are you returning home?" Kaka Mahajani was rather surprised at the question, but he had to give an answer. He said he would go home when Sai Baba ordered him to do so. Then Baba said, "Go tomorrow."
Baba's word was law and had to be obeyed. Kaka Mahajani therefore left Shirdi immediately. When he went to his office in Mumbai, he found his employer anxiously waiting for him. His Munim, the manager, had suddenly fallen ill, hence Kaka's presence was absolutely necessary. He had sent a letter to Kaka at Shirdi, which was then redirected to him at Mumbai. Bhau Sahib Dhumal. Now listen to another story. Once, Bhau Sahib Dhumal was going to Nipat for a case. On the way, he came to Shirdi, took Baba's darshan and wanted to proceed to Nipat immediately. But Baba did not permit him to do so. He made him stay at Shirdi for a week or more. In the meanwhile, the magistrate at Nipat suffered intensely from pain in his abdomen and the case was adjourned. Mr. Dhumal was then allowed to go and attend to his case. It went on for some months and was tried by four magistrates. Ultimately, Mr. Dhumal won the case and his client was acquitted. Mrs. Nimonkar. Mr. Nana Sahib Nimonkar, Watandar of Nimon, an honorary magistrate, was staying at Shirdi with his wife. Mr. and Mrs. Nimonkar were spending most of their time in the masjid with Baba and serving him. It so happened that their son fell ill at Belapur and the mother decided with Baba's consent to go to Belapur and see her son and other relatives and stay there for a few days. But Mr. Nana Sahib asked her to return the next day. The lady was in a fix. She did not know what to do. But her god Sai came to her help. While leaving Shirdi, she went back to Baba, who was standing in front of Sathe's Wada with Mr. Nana Sahib and the others. She prostrated at his feet and asked his permission to go. Baba said to her, "Go, go quickly. Be calm and unperturbed. Stay comfortably at Belapur for 4 days. See all your relatives and then return to Shirdi." How opportune were Baba's words. Mr. Nana Sahib's proposal was overruled by Baba's decree. Mule Shastri of Nasik. An orthodox Agnihotri Brahmin of Nasik, Mule Shastri, who had studied the six Shastras and was well versed in astrology and palmistry, once came to Shirdi to see Mr. Bapu Sahib Bhutti, the famous millionaire of Nagpur. After seeing him, he and the others went to see Baba in the masjid. Baba brought various fruits and other things from vendors with his own money and distributed them to the people present in the masjid. Baba used to press the mango on all sides so skillfully that when he sucked it, he got all the pulp at once in his mouth and could throw away the seed. Plantains were peeled off by Baba and the pulp was distributed to the devotees while the skins were retained by Baba for himself. Mule Shastri, as a palmist, wanted to examine Baba's palm and asked him to extend his hand. Baba ignored the request and gave him 4 plantains. Then they all returned to the Wada and Mule Shastri had his bath, wore fresh clothes and started his routine duties of Agnihotra, etc. Then Baba as usual started for Lendi and said, "Take some Geru." Geru is a red, miry substance used to dye clothes in saffron color. Baba said, "We shall today don saffron colored clothes." No one understood what Baba meant. Then after some time, when Baba returned and preparations for the noon aarti were being made, Bapu Sahib Jog asked Mule Shastri whether he would accompany him for the aarti. Mule Shastri replied he would see Baba in the afternoon. Baba sat on his seat, was worshipped by the devotees, and aarti commenced. Then Baba said, "Get some dakshina from that new Nasik Brahmin." Bhutti himself went to the Wada to get the dakshina, and when he gave Baba's message to Mule Shastri, he was sorely perplexed. He thought in his mind, "I am a pure Agnihotri Brahmin. Why should I pay dakshina? Baba may be a great saint. I am not his dependent." But since a great saint like Sai Baba was asking for dakshina through a millionaire like Bhutti, he could not refuse. So leaving his routine unfinished, he started with Bhutti for masjid. Thinking himself holy and the masjid otherwise, he remained at a distance and after joining his palms threw flowers at Baba from there. Then lo, all of a sudden, he saw not Baba, but his late Guru Gholap Swami there. He was wonderstruck. Could this be a dream? No, it was not, as he was wide awake. But how could his late Guru Gholap be there? He was speechless for some time. He pinched himself and thought again, but could not reconcile the fact of his late Guru Gholap being in the masjid. Ultimately, leaving aside all doubt, he went up, fell at his Guru's feet, and then stood there with folded hands. Other people sang Baba's Aarti, while Mole Shastri chanted loudly his Guru's name. Then, casting off all pride of caste and sacredness, he fell at his Guru's feet and closed his eyes. When he got up and opened his eyes, he saw Baba asking for Dakshina. Seeing Baba's blissful form and his inconceivable power, Mole Shastri forgot himself. He was extremely pleased. His eyes were full of tears of joy. He again saluted Baba and gave the Dakshina. He said that his doubt was removed and he saw his own Guru. On seeing this wonderful Leela of Baba, all the people, including Mole Shastri, were much moved, and they realized the meaning of Baba's words, "Bring Geru, we shall don saffron-colored cloth." Such is a wonderful Leela of Baba. A doctor. Once a Mamlatdar came to Shirdi with a doctor friend of his. The doctor said his deity was Ram and that he would not bow before a Muslim, and so he was unwilling to go to Shirdi. The Mamlatdar replied that nobody would be forced to bow down, so he should come and give the pleasure of his company. Accordingly, they reached Shirdi and went to the masjid for Baba's darshan. All were wonderstruck to see the doctor going ahead and saluting Baba. They asked him how he forgot his resolve and bowed down to a Muslim. The doctor replied that he saw his beloved deity Ram on the seat and he therefore prostrated himself before him. Then, as he began saying this, he again saw Sai Baba there. Being dismayed, he again said, "Is this a dream? How could he be a Muslim? He is a great yoga sampan avatar." Next day, he made a vow and began to fast. He stayed away from the masjid, resolving not to go there until Baba blessed him. 3 days passed, and on the fourth day, a close friend of his from Khandesh turned up, and with him he went to the masjid for Baba's darshan. After the salutation, Baba asked him whether anybody had gone to call him, so he had come. Hearing this vital question, the doctor was moved. The same night, he was blessed by Baba, and he experienced the bliss supreme in his sleep. Then, he left for his town, where he remained in the same state for a fortnight. Thus, his devotion for Baba increased manyfold. The moral of all these stories mentioned above, especially that of Mole Shastri, is that we should have firm faith in our Guru and no one else. More leelas of Sai Baba will be described in the next chapter. Bow to Sri Sai. Peace be to all. Chapter 13. More Sai Leelas. Diseases cured. Bhimaji Patil, Bala Shimpi, Bapu Saheb Bhuti, Alandi Swami, Kaka Mahajani, Dattopant of Harda. The inscrutable power of Maya. Baba's words were always short, deep, full of meaning, effective and well-balanced. He was ever content and never cared for anything. He said, "Though I am a fakir, have no house or wife, and though leaving off all care, I stay at one place. The inevitable Maya teases me often. Though I forget myself, she cannot forget me. She always envelops me. This Maya of the Lord harasses even Lord Brahma and others. Then what to speak of a poor fakir like me? Those who take refuge in the God will be freed from her clutches with his grace." In such terms, Baba spoke about the power of Maya. Lord Sri Krishna has said to Uddhava in the Bhagavat that the saints are his living forms. And see what Baba has said for the welfare of his devotees. "Those who are fortunate and whose demerits have vanished, take to my worship. If you always say Sai, Sai, I shall take you over the seven seas. Believe in these words and you will certainly be benefited. I do not need any paraphernalia of worship, either eightfold or sixteenfold. I rest there where there is full devotion. Now listen to what Sai did for the welfare of those who surrendered themselves to him.
Sai Guru Var ki Paramanand Sada. Sai Ram listeners, I have great pleasure in welcoming to our studios Dr. Ramanathan Iyer, whose name must be familiar to you because we have broadcast at least two interviews we have had with him. I shouldn't say interviews because there's a lot of misconception about the recordings we do when we have guests. Actually, they are conversations. An interview is one where you have an expert and a reporter who tries to seek information. In Sai Radio, we don't go like that. We like to have conversations. So, Doctor, while welcoming you to our studios, I'd like to make it very clear. You must give me the liberty of interrupting you when I like, because that's how we talk normally. Yes, so, I want to talk to you.
That's how it should be.
Okay. Last time, I think you made several passing mention of Ayurveda. What exactly does that word mean and why is it called Veda?
At the outset, I begin offering my reverential pranams at the lotus feet of my master, Bhagwan Satya Sai Baba. Sai Ram to you, sir. Sai Ram to all the wonderful listeners of Radio
Sai. By the way, we have heard a lot of comments. Greatly appreciative, of course, of all that you have said in the earlier conversations.
It's the Lord which uses this body as a medium.
That's true.
So, to all wonderful listeners of Radio Sai Global Harmony, my humble Sai Rams. Wonderful question, Ayurveda. This has been troubling me since my high school days. Why a particular system of medicine which originated in this country was called as a Veda? Because my understanding of Veda was restricted to something which has a religious or a spiritual connotation.
Mm-hmm.
And Ayur is basically life. And then later on when I dwelt on it, then I found that it is actually a upanga or a side branch of the Atharvana Veda.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they claim.
Mm-hmm.
Wherein they are not, see, never once are they mentioning anything about disease, infirmity or death.
Mm-hmm.
They are talking about life, longevity and health.
Well-being. Mm-hmm.
See, this is very fundamental. If you see comparing our modern system of medicine, I am personally trained in the modern system of medicine. The moment you are taught the basic normal anatomy and physiology, immediately after that, from that till I think you breathe your last, you are reading and practicing and treating only pathologies. Now herein is a system which is aiming as far as possible to maintain life, longevity, health, and well-being.
In that case, can I paraphrase what you said just now as follows? Ayurveda means the science of well-being.
Yes, it is.
Is that right?
It is.
Very good.
Yes. And it is not restricted to, like, you know, we have a codified thing in our modern medicine wherein you have a historical questionnaire, which may be verbal, or if it is in the US now, you have got printouts, computer handouts where the patient ticks about 50 or 60 questions and it's fed into the computer and the computer spews out, okay, consider the following differential diagnosis. You can't impersonalize.
Mm.
See, one fact you should understand that each individual body is unique. Though some generalized presentations or patterns of diseases can be mentioned, but the same disease, if you see 100 patients, you can see 100 presentations.
Okay, you mentioned this last time also, and that prompts me to ask a question at this point. Can you say that in the case of Ayurveda, it is dealing with well-being in a larger sense, not only purely from the physiological point of view, but also from the mental point of view, because as is the body's mind, so is the body. If the mind is unhealthy, the body will also be unhealthy. That's what you told us last time. Am I right in that?
This is part aspect of it.
Okay.
See, unfortunately, with due apologies to all present Ayurvedic practitioners, I am seeking a very deep apology because very few handful of such real, true, dedicated Ayurvedic practitioners are currently available in any part of the world. If they are really practicing their art as they should, theirs is a very holistic approach, number one.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, they don't see the individual or his organ or his disease. They see him as a whole, in which his physical aspect, his mental aspect, his spiritual well-being.
Mm, that's very good.
Mm. All of it are including, I may add it here, of course people, there will be some listeners who may object, even the use of astrology as an anga or a branch in the diagnosis of diseases in Ayurveda.
Is that right?
Was practiced.
Is that right?
Yes. This very few people are aware. I am stating it because at some point in time when I got interested, I did extensive reading. And I was surprised that from the time of arrival of a patient to a vaidya, as they used to call an Ayurvedic practitioner, even before he delves into, okay, what brings you here, or what is your problem, like the model, oh, doctor, I have a wheezing, or I have a stomachache, or I have a headache, his initial talk will be generalization. Okay, where are you from, what are you, what kind of work, and then finally only comes to, by that time, he gets a whole picture of what kind of an environment this man is in, what all could have resulted in his present set of symptoms, where the disturbances could have occurred. As you may be remembering, last time I mentioned about a beautiful word in English, the dis-ease. In fact, in the Ayurveda also, they do tell about disturbances in what they call the certain humors. But the methods which they use in modern medicine, okay, you have diagnostic tools. Okay, you draw a sample of blood or do some other test, and it is finally you are relying on what the tools spill out for you. So net result is, the more and more we are technologizing medicine, the more and more we are distancing ourselves from the patient.
By the way, this prompts me to ask a question. You know, we have many Ayurveda colleges here. Colleges where they teach Ayurveda, give degrees, diplomas, whatever. Do they do justice to the original spirit of Ayurveda, or do they treat it purely from the clinical point of view and treatment point of view?
Again, with utmost apologies, without injuring anybody's sentiments, because I don't wish to step on anybody's toes, but the fact is, the current state of teaching or transmission of knowledge in majority of the Ayurveda institutes is very, very dismal. It is neither Ayurveda nor modern medicine. It is the current state of affairs.
In other words, if I understand you correctly, the practice of Ayurveda calls for a pedagogy and methodology which is distinctly different from that of Western medicine.
Definitely. Why not? See, Western medicine, you have, okay, suppose in India you have what is called the 4.5 year training period for
basic. Irrespective of the duration of the period, there is a certain approach which is clinically good in terms of organ, diseased organ, what are the...
That is one aspect, sir. See, here, if I get 50% marks every year, in 4.5 years I get my MBBS. Another 1 year internship, I can get the degree. There the concept was, there may be a very brilliant kind of student who may get his basic things within 3 years. There may be another student who may take maybe 8 years. It was not compartmentalized. But today's thing is, okay, you gain an admission, you undergo that many years, that fixed duration of years, at the end of you to write something and you get the degree.
In other words, unless you reach a certain level, you should remain a student.
Yes.
It was an elastic system.
It very elastic system, and I feel that's how it should be in the modern system.
That I agree. But of course, it's very difficult to have that, a very complex society.
Very complex society, and there will be many people who will opt to what I'm saying. But what I say is, see, not everybody who comes to a system may gel with the system immediately.
Okay, there was a certain tradition in the practice of Ayurveda, and that was the way it was going on for centuries and centuries. At what point in our history did the methodology change? Am I right in saying it was after the advent of the British and their introduction of Western system of medicine? If I'm not mistaken, medical colleges started after 1857, somewhere thereabouts, 1860, 1870, the very first medical colleges.
Again,
at Grant Medical College in Bombay.
Again, with due apologies, I wish to go back to the origins, if you see history.
No, my question was, at what point did we give up our traditional approach to Ayurveda teaching?
If you may kindly allow me to little bit dilate on this, into the history of how the so-called Ayurvedic science has evolved through the centuries. See, there has been evidence which they have got from the Harappan times, that some kind of an indigenous medical system was in vogue at that point in time. But unfortunately, nothing much concrete could be got up from that. The first ever earliest concrete evidence which we find about available published literature in Ayurveda is the Charaka Samhita, about the first millennium BC, somewhere roughly they date it. And somewhere around that time, the Sushruta Samhita. Even today, any good traditional practitioner vouches by that.
What do these two Samhitas contain for the benefit of me, myself and our listeners?
Basically, I would say two great revered I would say rishis. Mm. I wouldn't hesitate to call them. And even today it baffles me.
Their names once again?
Charaka and Sushruta.
Who came first, Charaka?
Again, these periods in history, they are roughly around the same contemporaries. Okay. But one produced a system wherein he gives excellent anatomical details.
Oh, that
he
is
gives
Charaka
excellent details about symptoms of various diseases.
He understood circulation.
No, that is what, see, to me the problem is, see, I wish I had access to how, without the presence of so-called modern day technology, which I am exposed to, that's my ignorance, I would say, how he was able to find so much and write so much. And mind you, all of this he gives in the way of some descriptions, some aphorisms. And at the end of each chapter, he gives what he called the mnemonics in the form of a small shloka.
Mm.
Oh, this is the summarization of this topic, of this chapter. Mm. And Sushruta Samhita, if you say, you would say it is one of the, even today, it remains a landmark Ayurvedic literature on Ayurvedic surgery.
Surgery?
Yes.
That's interesting.
That's why I said I'm transgressing here at this point, because the so-called pedicle flap technique, which is used by modern day plastic surgeons for reconstruction of the nose using the forehead pedicle flap, actually is called the Sushruta technique. This was, imagine how many thousands of years back Sushruta had perfected
the technique. That is staggering. You know why? If you can't think of modern surgery without anesthetics.
Yes.
How did he manage?
That is why I say there are many unanswered signs. Because even today, any student undergoing training in plastic surgery, when he reads about the nasal reconstruction, the pedicle flap method using a forehead flap of skin, it's called the Sushruta technique. And in fact, he is revered as the father of modern day plastic surgery. This is just one. There have been numerous other institutions. They had those days ability to perform surgeries to remove renal kidney stones, bladder stones. They were performing even something the equivalent of our present day cesarean sections.
But what about anesthetics?
There have been mention. See, that is why I say, see, you have this currently available literature, if you see. One is the Charaka Sushruta Samhita.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have texts called Ashtanga Hridaya and Ashtanga Sangraha, which date a few more centuries after, attributed to a saint or a rishi or a vaidya called Vagbhata. And later on...
What does that contain?
That actually, I would say, is a reinterpretation of the Charaka and Sushruta. A reinterpretation based on the needs of that time. I don't feel wrong about it. Along with times, it has to change. I don't deny. Then later on, Sarangadhara Samhita, around 14th or 15th century, like that you have got. So, like this, there are, in bits and pieces, you have got what you call published work. To me, what baffles is, see, they had an understanding of the anatomy. They had an understanding of the physiology.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, to that extent, fine. What kind of a power of observation they would have had to codify symptoms and signs of a whole bunch of diseases using only possibly their sense organs given by God as diagnostic tools, number one. This is one aspect which even today baffles me of Ayurveda. Number two, they didn't have our kind of modern chemical labs or the pharmacy labs wherein you take up a chemical, you do the initial preliminary animal studies, and in the animals you decide the toxicity levels and the effects and the side effects, and finally it gets approved for the phase one human trial, what they call. Then that gets cleared, then goes to the phase two, and then finally goes for approval by any approval agency till it finally hits the market. And that is why any modern drug today, by the time it hits the market, already millions of dollars have already been spent. So the company which has spent that much on research has to get back. That is why most of the medicines today are prohibitively costly, at least in the initial 2 or 3 years. At that point in time, because I am not aware what kind of a system they had to know the so-called beneficial effects. See, Ayurveda basically, if you see, it has used a lot of plant products as their medication.
I was going to come to that.
The plant products as their medication. It doesn't end with that. People think Ayurveda meant only using some leaves and herbs and fruit juices. It is not so. They have used salts of various metals. They have used even heavy metals in their preparation. They have had internal medication system. They had a very evolved external medication system, a system involving massage, of a whole set of medicated oils. Now my question is, where did all this knowledge come from? In which kind of a lab was it rigorously tested? How did the knowledge that a particular plant, in fact, I remember some years back, I was reading a book, it was written that one of these masters, it seems, sent his pupil out and said, go and search. He gave a particular area. Go and search all plants in that area. And come back and tell me if you can find one plant which doesn't have a medicinal value. So after that, the student comes back and says, Master, I'm sorry, but I couldn't find a single plant which doesn't have some or the other medicinal value. Now, what were the ways and methods by which they tested it? Unfortunately, these are all dark areas.
This prompts me to ask a question. It is connected with plants and herbs, which are, I believe, extensively used in Ayurvedic treatment even today. You see, India is a very vast country, and the climatology varies enormously. In Kerala, you have, lots of rains, and you have places like Rajasthan, which are pretty barren in most places, and then you have northern regions which get pretty cold in winter and so on. Obviously, the flora varies considerably. Under the circumstances, there must have been a lot of variation in the kind of medication and treatment given by Ayurvedic people in different parts of the country. Or am I wrong? You understand my question?
Yes. Mm. No, that's what. Since you started with the topic, I go with what is called established names. Charaka, Shushruta, Vagbhata, and Srangadhara and all. Now, there is again this controversy which I directed long back, because they say the Vedas itself was an introduction due to Aryan invasion in this country. That is what is the current accepted. Mm-hmm. And during that time only, the arrival of Ayurveda also took place. Okay. And then its growth was seen. Now, as you rightly said, most of what you see of the present Ayurveda did originate in the northern parts of the country. Now, at the same time, as you rightly pointed out, in the southern parts of the country also, there have been, but which didn't become as popular as the current Charaka or Sushruta, but there have been pockets where there have been traditional family setups who have been following. From father to son, it has been being transmitted, and they've been going for 12, 15 generations. They have been existing. They have their own pharmacopoeia.
Based on local herbs.
Local herbs and local, what you call, salts, local metals. The unfortunate part of most of those kinds of setups, some of which do exist even today in Kerala, for your kind information. I am at least aware of one family which has been, I think, in this practice for more than 11 or 12 generations.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is, it is tradition bound that it is from within their family. They don't let out the secret to anybody else. Two, they claim it's an oral tradition, which I have my own doubts. So I feel my objection to that is, limiting knowledge never allows growth.
That is true.
So that is why if what is current of today's Ayurveda is, most of the companies, they will say, if you see any medication, he'll write, it is according to Charaka Samhita or Ashtanga Hridaya. It will be written in
the text. So if I understand you correctly, the basic schools were up in the north.
Yes.
And there were sort of localized expertise.
Definitely.
Scattered, not linked.
Not linked.
Okay. That prompts me to ask a certain question, and I am drawing inspiration from the field of music. You know, in music, especially in the north, you have different schools.
Yes.
Their tradition, different gurus. Unlike in south, where we have a different tradition. Now, as far as Ayurveda is concerned, its lineage goes back to Charaka and Sushruta, if I get the name correct. How did the schools of Ayurveda get established for this to be spread? For example, in the case of Vedas, we know there were mathams where the Veda chanting was practiced, and that's how it spread. Was there any methodology or procedure or social systems by which Ayurveda spread?
Yes. Available knowledge, again, is whatever is available by printed literature or commentaries written by later-day people about these contemporaries. Now, if you see, basically, there have been two, three kinds of influences which affected the growth of Ayurveda in this country. One, this is actually reflected even in their books. Initially, it was actually aimed at those days, king and his, in the well-being of the king and his family members.
Mm-hmm.
That is how basically the so-called Veda or the science got evolved.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were supposed to be maybe next only to God.
Mm-hmm.
So any kind of an affliction affecting the local king or his family members, that was how the thing started. And royal patronage was provided to the Vaidyas. And I think for quite some time, it was beyond the reach of a common man. For quite some time. Till as time progressed, the influence of Buddhism, in fact, there is enough evidence available that in the period of Bhagavan Buddha and that maybe couple of centuries, they patronized Ayurveda a lot. So much so, I remember reading that there was a time that the local people preferred to get converted to Buddhist monks because they could get access to the Ayurvedic system of medicine.
I see.
This is, I am talking time period of in the growth. Till slowly it started growing, disseminating, and the body of knowledge started increasing. See, to me, unfortunately, there is no data available as to on what basis, suppose I see a plant. Now, how do I test its efficacy? Or how do I know? Say, for example, I gave last time also the example of Rauwolfia serpentina. Now, how would they have known that this plant has got a diuretic property, that is, it causes passage of excess of urine, or for that matter, it is excellent in reducing the blood pressure? Today, okay, in a lab you have got guinea pigs or other experimental animals, you test it and see. Two, methods of extracting from the plant, whatever the plant uses. Three, methods of preservation. How many years would it have taken? You may be aware that as you ask me about, you can say, were there other local schools? In fact, the Siddha which evolved in this part of the country, mainly the south, was, you can say, actually a parallel evolution of Ayurveda in this region.
What about Unani?
Now I'll come to that.
Mm-hmm.
Our question which you started was, from whence did this decline in the influence of Ayurveda started? Sadly, but it's a fact, it was from the time of Mughal invasion.
Mm.
For quite some time, Ayurveda did flourish during the period. Because what has happened, as I said in the beginning, it is believed that like the Vedas, this too also was an Aryan import.
Mm.
Apparently, there is some connection that knowledge of this, I mean, the Ayurvedic branch, was shared by residents of Mesopotamia, Greece and all.
Mm-hmm.
And there came a stage when later on the Muslim invaders came.
Mm.
They in turn took some knowledge from this and then they claimed that it belongs their own and named it as Unani. In fact, there are many similar parallels between medications in Ayurveda and Unani.
In other words, you would say Unani is a Muslim tradition
of Ayurveda. Ayurveda, if you say. Mm. So then that came into prominence. But to be fair enough, the Mughal invasion didn't mean that it was the death knell for Ayurveda. The actual death knell was sounded after the British invasion. So much so that...
Through the introduction of Western medicine?
Number one.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, for some years in the early years of British rule also, the so-called modern medicine of that time, as well as Ayurveda, coexisted. Till, if I remember lately, it was Lord Macaulay who put a thing that the only system of medicine which will be recognized by governmental agencies will be the Western medicine. All other forms of medicine won't get any kind of patronage or recognition. And that's where the slow decadence set in. Because then the practitioners, once they don't have patronage, they have to fend for themselves. So slowly, we came to a stage wherein after we finally let go of the clutches of Britishers, we gained independence. Unfortunately, post-independence, we allowed ourselves to be dictated by the modern medicine. And half a century has gone by. Still, no concerted effort was made, at least to reinterpret Ayurveda in the modern life.
Okay, supposing we have to give a big boost to Ayurveda, what do you think we should be doing?
See, like any other fact, you test a new hypothesis against an established fact. So today, any other system of medicine, if you have to test, obviously it will have to stand to the rigors of the so-called tested scientific methods of modern medicine.
Okay.
Which says that, okay, you have to have efficacy studies, toxicity studies and all those things. Now, there is, again, as I said, there is one fundamental difference between the approach followed in modern medicine versus the approach followed in Ayurveda. As I pointed out, again, last time, I'm repeating that example. When they discovered this Rauwolfia serpentina, I would say rediscovered, not discovered, extensive lab studies, they found out the active principle was reserpine. Very potent antihypertensive effect. Very potent. So much so that it was a drug very popular for quite some years for hypertensive emergency. Somebody lands up with, say, blood pressure of say, 240 over 160. Give him a shot of reserpine. In next 10 or 15 minutes, it plummets down to 90 by 70. That kind of a powerful medication. Modern medicine isolated the active principle, gave it. Over the years, then there was an oral formulation to continue. Over the years, they found that its usage for acute crisis or on a long-term basis, the side effect profile was not very attractive. And that is why slowly, slowly the use got restricted. Now, way back, centuries back, I would say, centuries back, the extract of the same plant, it is mentioned in the text. One of the uses of it was for treating hypertension. Even now, there are companies which give you extract, maybe in the form of dried extract, in the form of some tablet, or maybe in the form of what they call Arista, which may be roughly translated into a self-generated alcohol base of the medicament. That's what roughly translated Arista stands for. Whichever form you give, patient has a much smoother control of blood pressure. He doesn't suffer these untoward side effects. Now, this aspect of it, if at all you need to test the traditional Ayurvedic medicine against the standards established by modern medicine, this aspect has to be answered. Which means, whenever you are taking an active principle from nature, from say a plant source, nature has put it in such a way there are counteracting principles. So possibly a crude extract, though maybe a shade little less efficacious, from the safety profile is much better than going for purified extract. Another example, if you may kindly permit, because it was done in modern India. There is a plant known as Gugul. You must have heard of it. Commiphora mucul is the botanical name. Again mentioned in the traditional literature, is used for Medha Roga or obesity. Medha Roga is what is the term they call for obesity. Now, at the Banaras Hindu University, the initial work started, their Ayurvedic setup. And later on it was shifted to the CDRA Lucknow, Central Drug Research Institute Lucknow, wherein they extensively studied the plant and its components. And then they found out that what they'll call the Gugul sterons, a group of chemicals which they extracted from the plant, they said, these Gugul sterons have an effect in lowering the blood lipids. And then they sold it to some company and a particular company marketed the product for some years. I was keen, so I also did use it in some patients. But with so much of media hype and publicity, the results were not as expected. They again used some esterified, some extract of the Gugul sterons they use. One example. Two, you must have seen in the maybe around last 5 years back or something, a plant called Brahmi. Stated to have excellent properties on improving memory and retention and recall and all.
Again, you know, they used to talk of Brahmi Tailam.
So many things. It is available as an oil, the Brahmi Tailam as an oil, as an internal medication. And in fact, if you read the Ayurveda literature about Brahmi, and if you read about its uses, you will be stupefied. Such a wonder. And it's you can grow it in the backyard of your house. It's such a innocuous kind of plant. Now, this Brahmi, again, a study done in the CDRA Lucknow, they isolated what they called the Bacocytes A and B as the agents or the component in it, which is known to stimulate memory. Again, the technology was sold to some company, and the company started raking money. Virtually, you can say, conning parents and students that, okay, this is the final product for your child if he takes it memory. And it was being sold at an astronomical cost. And one very leading personality of this country, I don't want to have controversies, advertised for it. Because he was a sports person indulging in a cerebral game, and he advertised for it. And that was a further impetus to promote the sales. But sadly, because I have seen so many users of it, and I have seen users of the traditional Brahmi, which is made by the traditional Ayurvedic method, you get results there, you don't get results
here. Okay, if I can paraphrase you, based on modern drug research, about which I know a thing, little bit. Because basically they design drugs now.
Exactly.
Because they find that if you take a protein, for example, there are certain sites which are really responsible for dealing with the counter sites in the disease or protein or whatever.
Receptor-mediated action.
The rest of it is just a carrier, a backbone. Now, all the side effects that you mentioned are associated with the carriers.
Yes.
The same active agents, if they can be put in an innocuous carrier, then you won't have this problem. If I understand you correctly, nature had done this. It is only when we start extracting, we lose all the insulation given by nature and we end up with side effects.
See, that is where I said, see, today you have a technology. Question is application of the technology. Which in this country, in 50 years of independence, we could have easily done it for the entire...
In other words, if you go to the original plant product and see what was the kind of carrier that made it innocuous...
That has to be studied. That was never done.
Okay. You need to use the tools of molecular biology and things like that.
To study
and
that.
And biochemistry. Yes.
One aspect. Second aspect, they use heavy metals.
Hmm.
They use heavy metals.
Which is considered bad news.
Which is considered very bad news. But how did they come to so-called the dose fixation? In fact, if you see their Ayurvedic dose fixation for some of the heavy metals, what we call in today's terms as micrograms and picograms, even they have been talking in terms of that. Where did they have the weighing scales for that? And efficacy. See, they have used gold, antimony, arsenic. People with today, as a doctor, I would dread to prescribe arsenic or antimony to a patient. They had products. And tested products, one aspect of it. Two, people used to, as I told you, their approach was holistic. There was one system which you must have heard. You talked of local schools of Ayurveda. One such thing is the Kerala school, which has the famous Panchakarma, which is now selling like hotcakes. Basically, various purificatory rites performed on the body, external as well as internal. So, which involved inducing emesis or vomiting by using certain medicines, inducing purgation, giving medicated enemas, medicated, you can say, oil dripping on the head. It is not in milliliters, liters of oil.
Hey God.
Not milliliter, liters of oil.
Today's cause, that will be approximate.
That is why the cost is astronomical. Then, specific kind of massage for the entire body. And at the end of it, you feel you are 10 years younger. See, now I am interpreting this in modern light. How these would be acting?
Since you have to now leave, I am looking at the clock because you have to go to the hospital shortly. I have not forgotten that. Let me ask you a couple of quick questions so that you can wind up and then leave, because I know something is waiting for you there. One of the questions is, you know, these days we have a lot of blood pressure and sugar problems. Many people have that. Obviously, this must have existed in earlier times.
It has been
described. You talked of a drug that brings down the BP. How did they get an idea of the BP? Was it from the nadi, from the pulse?
Obviously. See, they, at least to my knowledge, if you go dating back to available printed literature, the first ever study attributed to recording of blood pressure was to Stephen Hales, wherein he thrust a cannula into the horse's artery and then saw a column of water going up to show that, okay, the blood exerts pressure. That's how it started. That's around 1640 or something like that. Before that, they didn't have an instrument to that. So, see, that is why I said there are, again, I would say dark areas. How did they get this knowledge?
How did they know what blood sugar?
Blood sugar, yes.
Today, that, you go and get your blood sample sugar. Tested. But they knew about diabetes.
Definitely. Madhumeha. Madhumeha was the Sanskrit term for diabetes. And it is described, the patient with madhumeha, wherein he urinates, ants normally avoid urine because it contains a lot of urea and other products which is toxic to it. A diabetic's urine attracts ant. So see, a power of observation. This is what was written. The same kind of thing, what all kinds of observation they might have had. See, of course, it is out of context today, number one, plus there is paucity of time. A similar thing, I marvel at the way yoga and pranayama developed. Because I remember having read long back as a schoolboy in one of the yoga books that most of the asanas were derived watching animals in nature.
Yes, we have the Mayurasana for peacock and so many things.
So I am thrilled. See how looking at a peacock or a swan, an elephant or some other element in a particular posture. And then somebody gets an, you call it intuition, that okay, if I develop this posture, it has this effect. And there have been treatises published at that point in time. Okay, if you do this, you have these benefits. And they were not tested against the rigors of so-called modern medical scientific methods.
But there are valid empirical observations.
Very much valid, and many of them are now being validated by
modern methods. Okay. One last question, because I am really looking at the clock. There's a place called Puttur near Tirupati.
Yeah.
And they do a lot of this orthopedic fixing, shall I call it? You call it bone healing, that's a better word. Is that a part of formal Ayurveda, or did orthopedics not exist in Ayurveda? That is the first part of the question. Second part is, I have myself seen these Puttur fellows work wonders in the case of some of my colleagues who had fractures, rather nasty fractures after scooter accidents, at least two I know. And they went to the usual hospitals and plaster and all that sort of thing. It didn't work. They went to Puttur. They came back much better. So maybe you can shed some light on that.
See, again, these are what I call localized family-based traditions.
Okay, that's what you mentioned earlier.
Family-based traditions.
That seems to be the case there.
Not only this. There are so many others which I am aware of. The problem with most of...
But those things are genuine.
I can't vouch for it today. Now you may ask me why. Because many of the plants which have been mentioned in the ancient literature are hard to find by now.
But
since you have established a tradition, you want to carry it forward.
See, this person who had the accident, I asked him, he was my neighbor in Kilpakkam. I have suffered a fracture and I know what it is. To fix it, this happened in 50 years ago exactly. And they gave me anesthetics, chloroform in those days, and then a boring hospital, and the doctor fixed it. After 40 minutes, I came out of my, lock of consciousness. So I asked him, damn thing is damn painful. How did you manage? He said, they put some leaves and tied it, and it became very chill and became very numb. Then they fixed the bones. I was just amazed.
You asked about the question about anesthesia.
Yes.
There are enough number of such things present in plant extracts which can have this kind of local effects. See, I would have welcomed one question from you.
Sorry.
One question from you was, which I would expect it at the beginning, that how did I develop an interest in Ayurveda? I think the listeners should also know because...
Okay, we'll let you have the last word.
because... I was born and brought up in a so-called modern scientific training, modern schooling, modern science. So my ways and methods are even today based on that. When I passed my 10th class board exam, I suffered a food poisoning. I ate some kind of fungus-infected bakery product. After that, I had a food poisoning. The fallout of what that was, every day 5 to 6 times, I used to get huge allergic patches all over the body. There will be severe intense itching, head to toe I will get. 5 to 6 such episodes. Now with that, I am taken to the industrial hospital where my father was working. I became an experimental guinea pig for them. I was asked hundreds of uncomfortable questions because I was in the 11th class. So they thought that maybe I had taken any kind of forbidden food or substances which might have triggered it. So many such questions. Nothing of that was there. I told, this is the thing. This is what has happened. After that, I'm getting it. I had never got it before. So normally the modern medicine way of treatment is they use antihistaminics. That is drugs which are used to counter allergy. All possible available antihistaminic drugs in Indian market was experimented on this 11-year-old boy at that point in time. This went on for nearly 7 to 8 months.
My God.
Each visit I go, and mind you, all the antihistaminics available at that point in time caused drowsiness. And you know how much 11th class is important for a student in this country, wherein you have selected a subject, you have to pursue your future direction. And herein I am thrice a day taking the medicine and drowsy and trying to cover my subjects. at the end of it, finally, I was referred to a skin specialist, I was referred to a very senior physician. They examined all possible blood parameters. At the end of it, finally, what they did? They put me on steroids.
Oh, God.
Net result, it stunted my growth. That is why possibly I would have grown another 2 or 3 inches tall. My growth got arrested. Two, my parents were very happy because their lean and thin son, over a 3-month period, became plump. Another side effect of steroid. Parents being non-medicos, they didn't know that this was a side effect of steroid. In spite of that, the frequency came down but didn't stop. Till one day, that point in time, a biology teacher in the school who has a PhD in zoology, he wasn't directly my teacher, whom I later on considered or made as my first guru. He saw in front of him, I got this attack. And you know, it was what we call urticaria in modern, this one. You itch and you get big wheels and rashes, and it's horrible. You can't stand any in front, in a public place it happens. How can you do it? It's so bad. And you look so ugly. Your lip swells, your tongue swells, your breathing difficulty. So he saw me getting the attack, and unfortunately that day I had actually delayed the drug. So he asked me, since when are you getting it? I told, it's almost a year now, and this is what I'm on. Now this gentleman hailed from a family where Ayurveda as a tradition was passing on from grandfather to father like that, though he himself was a PhD in zoology.
Mm-hmm.
But he had this legacy from his father. So he told me, okay Ramnath, if you don't mind, I'll get you a medicine tomorrow, an Arista, which I mentioned. It's, you can say, a solution of a concoction in self-generated alcohol. That is what it is. I'll get you tomorrow. Just take it for 15 days. I can vouch for you, you won't have any side effects. I am very sure, I strongly feel that you will get benefit out of it. As I told you, I was trained in modern. I said, that's all nonsense. You just put some black jaggery and make some concoction and put some leaves, and then you sell and make money. I have no belief in what he's giving. He said, I am not asking you to believe it. I am not even asking money for it. But I can tell you it won't do you any harm. At least for my sake, why don't you take for 15 days? I reluctantly agreed. He brought me the bottle. 450 ml was the quantity. He asked me to take 15 ml of that medicine twice a day. I said, okay, when he has told, he's a teacher, I should obey. I religiously followed. This is now, everybody should listen carefully. For 1 year, itching became a part of my life. If I didn't have my usual spells of itching, I'll feel I'm not happy. Within the second day, I was surprised. The itching intensity and frequency came down. The third day, the whole day passed, I didn't have a single episode. Meanwhile, my teacher, he had told, don't stop your medicine, the other medicine, abruptly. By the fourth day, of course, I was tempted. I withdrew that. I said, let me try this. I continued it. So 15 ml twice a day, that comes to 30 ml a day. 15 days, 450 ml. I took it religiously for 15 days. By the Lord's grace, I never got it after that. That was when I realized that what I thought or dismissed of as just a concoction of jaggery water can work so much wonders.
Okay. So I would like to tell our listeners, we don't necessarily need to have a horrible experience like that. We can take our good doctor's word and have faith in genuine Ayurveda. We need not go to fakes. I'm sure you'll agree with me. Doctor, it's time, because I'm looking at the watch and you're needed in the hospital. I don't want to deny your services to a patient. Of course, there are others looking after, but you're needed there. But I'll take a rain check. You must come back, and there are a number of other things we have to talk about for our benefit and benefit of all our listeners. So please do come back and be in touch with all of us all over the world. Your wisdom, your knowledge, your experience is inspiring and stimulating. Thank you. Sai Ram.
Thank you so much, sir. I feel pain that I had to leave early today because of a commitment. But at the same time, I feel it's only by this kind of a dissemination that there are many brains around the world which will be set into thinking. And I hope that by Swami's grace, many such opportunities will come by and he will give us the final direction, the final answer.
He is the ultimate doctor.
Sai Ram to all listeners and Sai Ram to you, sir. Jai Sai Ram.
Soham, soham, dhyan karo. ध्यान करो
सद्गुरु साईं ध्यान करो
सद्गुरु साईं ध्यान करो
सद्गुरु साईं ध्यान करो
सोहम सोहम ध्यान करो करो
सोहम सोहम ध्यान करो
सद्गुरु साई ध्यान करो
सद्गुरु साई ध्यान करो
सोहम सोहम ध्यान करो सोहम ब्रह्मा सोहम विष्णु
सोहम ब्रह्मा सोहम विष्णु
सोहम साई ध्यान करो
सोहम साई ध्यान करो
सोहम आत्मा शिव परमात्मा
करो सद्गुरु ब्रह्म सनातन हे सनातन हे परम दयाघन पावन हे परम दयाघन पावन जन्म ज दुख विनाशन हे जन्म ज दुख विनाशन हे
विष्णु महेश Thank you.